Welcome to The Pamphlet, a podcast uncovering Unitarian Universalism's hidden histories.
Welcome to The Pamphlet. I'm Sean Neil Barron, your amateur UU history geek.
And I'm Susan Ritchie, your Unitarian Universalist historian.
Welcome to episode 8 of The Pamphlet, where we are diving into the Universalist origins, and you'll get that pun, or maybe you already have later, of this, the half of our name, the Universalist aspect of our tradition. And before we do that, we just have a few thank yous to people who donated to our Faithify campaign, because them, like you, the people who are listening, are making this all possible. So thank you to Justine Sullivan, Jim and Jackie Mason, Curtis Murphy, Joe Cherry, and Johanna Murphy. Your donations support the work that we're doing and make this all possible. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for supporting us. We'll try to earn your trust.
We're trying. Another way you can help support the pamphlet is by promoting us. So we post on Facebook each episode. If you want to share that link to your network, that's where a lot of people are learning about the pamphlet. So we would love your support, sharing us on Facebook, joining our mailing list at pamphletpodcast.org/pamphletsociety. Those are great ways of making sure you're in the know so that you can spread the word. And word of mouth, probably the best way that people learn about anything, even in this technological age. So if there's someone that you think would really, really enjoy a podcast about UU history with us fascinating people, you should just tell them about it. So why don't we dive into our topic today, which is about the origins of Universalism in America. And Susan, why don't you tell us the story that we all know about how Universalism came to America? And I'm putting you in the position of telling a story that you, that I know that you don't believe, but I think you're a good one to tell it, and I'll jump in as we get to the end.
Right. Well, there are many variations of this story, and I'm sure you all listening know some of them, but this is, of course, the story about how John Murray brought Universalism to America. And again, there are different versions, but I'll give you kind of one of the more extreme ones. And I've seen this done as a puppet play. I've seen it done as a song. I've seen it done as RE skits. So this is absolutely everywhere. But according to this story, John Murray was a Universalist preacher in London when his family died. Excuse me, I'm already getting it wrong. I'm already getting the wrongness wrong, if that's possible. But he went to prison for debt. The preaching thing wasn't working out for him. And while he was in prison, his wife and his daughter died. And so he vowed to give up this ministry thing that wasn't working out for him, and vowed to give up on Universalism, which wasn't turning out the way he expected. So when he's released from prison, he takes the first ship to the New World, to North America. And I believe the ship was actually called something like the Hand of God, or just something completely over the top like that.
And that's true? Like, we think that's accurate?
Yeah, we'll get to the accurate pieces in just a minute, and where all that does or doesn't come from. But according to the story, the ship gets caught on a sandbar outside of New Jersey, and this, of course, is often the opportunity for pulpit humor, to talk about our first Universalist miracle taking place in New Jersey. And of course, the miracle is a very small one, because what happens is the ship gets stuck on the sandbar. John Murray goes ashore in order to get provisions, knocks on the farmhouse of a gentleman named Thomas Potter, who opens the door and says, "Ah, are you the Universalist preacher for whom I have been waiting?"
Dun, dun, dun.
I know, right. And of course, Thomas Potter has already built a chapel just waiting for someone who might preach Universalism from his pulpit. But of course, John Murray says, "No, I can't preach, because, you know, this Universalist minister thing, it was exactly what I vowed to give up. But if the ship is still on the sandbar by Sunday morning, I will preach Universalism from your pulpit." And so here's our big small miracle. The ship was still on the sandbar Sunday morning. And so, according to the tale, John Murray then preaches Universalism, hence brings Universalism to the New World.
What a story. So the one hole in there's many interesting historical inaccuracies in this story, which we're going to get to. But I think the biggest one, which is kind of like the chalice, which is kind of in plain view already, is the fact that Thomas Potter opens the door and says, "Are you the Universalist minister I've been waiting for?" And this story is supposed to be how Universalism got to America. And of course, it's kind of a weird, it's a bit of a weird thing to say that the way Universalism got to America was a Universalist minister arrived, and then a person who was already a Universalist welcomed him. And so the question is, how did Thomas Potter become a Universalist? Was it some sort of personal conversion experience to Universalism that was done disconnected from any religious movement that was already going on, which would make the story even more amazing or maybe unbelievable to some of you? Or was there some sort of... was there some sort of Universalist movement going on in the colonies before the arrival of John Murray? That's a question that I think we're going to be investigating a little bit. But Susan, why do you think we love this story so much?
We love it for so many ways. Although, you know, I have to say for years, I find it very ironic that we love it because its theological suppositions are not those usually heard from our pulpits.
that God works through marooning ships.
Exactly. And the purpose of God is to override our own fallacious free will. But anyway, there is a reason we tell this story. And actually, in all fairness, the story itself comes from John Murray's autobiography. So this is much as he tells it himself. But one thing about John Murray is he was an absolute brilliant self-promoter. And so it was totally in his interest to depict himself as the person who came from Europe bringing this gift of Universalism. And there were all kinds of folks who wanted to hear precisely that story. I mean, it's a very tellable story, right? These stories where we have great men acting in kind of heroic in large ways, they translate beautifully to all these songs and skits and different ways of telling the story that we've evolved. And, you know, I think there's a slightly more sinister reason, too, that it spread so widely. It spread widely not just inside of Universalist circles, but anti-Universalist circles. The reason being that there were people who were resistant to Universalism were happier to think of it as being a kind of wicked import than to think of it as an American grassroots phenomenon, which I like to think of Universalism as an American grassroots phenomenon, and as did many later Universalists. I remember when Henry Billows and Thomas Whitmore were having their conversations about whether it was time for Unitarianism and Universalism to merge, you know, 100 years before it actually happened. Bellows said some catty things to Whitmore about perhaps the Universalists weren't of a class to join Unitarians. But Thomas Whitmore, the brilliant Universalist preacher, had just such a beautiful comeback. He said, "Well, perhaps Universalism is this beautiful wildflower that grows readily on the snowy hillsides in New England. And maybe Unitarianism is a hothouse flower that has to be protected and seen only by a few." But anyway, I just love the idea. I just like thinking of Universalism as indeed a kind of indigenous American wildflower. Mm.
And of course, this story isn't the only thing that we make up about John Murray. There's a famous quote that for most of my life as a Unitarian, I always thought John Murray said, which is this beautiful saying that that we need to go out onto the byways and the highways and give the people not hell but hope. And of course, this was attributed to John Murray, but it wasn't John Murray. It was made up in the 1950s. A Tufts professor speaking about kind of Murray's zeitgeist, which is kind of amazing.
You know, I love that story, and people always expect to find that I'm disappointed that John Murray didn't say those famous words. I think it's like way cooler that he didn't say those famous words because it implies that, you know, that once you're inside of a universalist tradition, you have access to that kind of spirit of history message, whether or not you're a great person or a student at Tufts or a professor at Tufts, just trying to imagine what Murray was up to.
Tufts being a universalist school, in founding.
Exactly. And at that time, Tufts was still operating a universalist seminary. Alas, so many of those closed.
So, why don't we kind of take a step back and think about, you know, maybe some of the more the less mythological origins of universalism as it is kind of presently in North America. I think it is important for us to connect with the school of thought which converted John Murray to universalism in the first place, because that will have an impact on universalism in the United States later on. So we said and we mentioned that Murray converted to universalism in Britain. But maybe Susan, you can talk a little bit about the kind of universalism that was being preached that he connected with. I think this is the Relian thought, and I'm forgetting the name of the person.
Yeah, John Relly,
This
exactly.
is
Yeah.
John Relly.
Right. He was the Methodist minister who came to the point of view of universal salvation and did organize a congregation that preached those ideas in London. And the basic theological point of view there was that really Christ's saving action was sufficient. That in saving humanity, Christ really saved humanity. And so that this kind of notion that at the end of life you would be submitted to a judgment that could possibly deny you eternal salvation was a way of falsely suggesting that Christ didn't save all of us.
And of course, the saving act is death on the cross.
Yes, exactly. And I do think it's key to remember that for many of these early universalists, they come to universalism not through a low Christology, by
But a
emphasizing
very
the
high
human
one.
nature of Jesus, but an incredibly high Christology, where Jesus has you know, unbelievably profound divine powers, and that's precisely why those powers were thought to be adequate.
So that's definitely one strand of universalism that gets imported to the colonies and later to the United States, this kind of Relian high Christology. This is what Murray is preaching at the Independent Church in Gloucester that he was called as the minister. This is the theology that informs the Universalist catechisms that Judith Sargent Murray is writing in the Sunday schools that they're starting. Incidentally, she basically kept the church afloat by her
Exactly.
connections in Gloucester, which is maybe another episode. So that's kind of the one core strand of Universalists in America. It's a very important. There's a few others. So one important one is the Pennsylvanian Pietists, which were in America long before Murray's fateful journey. And these were a group of folks who had a very different theological underpinning to their universalism. They had a much more Gnostic understanding of universalism, which basically meant that they thought that universal salvation was true, but it was this secret inst the secret insight that they had come to through the studying of the scripture. My favorite of the Pennsylvania Pietists was a man who wrote under the pseudonym Siegvok, and he wrote this beautiful tract which basically said, if everything was created and emanates from the Creator, it must cycle back. It must return to the Creator because everything that the Creator created is in some way good. And that doesn't mean that you're just going to automatically lickety-split when you die, come back to God. But in fact, God is probably going to torment you in hellfire for what feels like eternity, which is actually just burning off the kind of human sin, which is imperfecting creation. But there's nothing that we humans can do that could ultimately, in eternity, break us from God. And I always thought that was a really beautiful vision, because it evoked to me this kind of like cycle of life, that there's nothing that you can do to break this cycle of return. There's ways that you can make it longer, make it harder. It just makes you think of what we're doing to our Earth, that I don't think there's anything that we can do that will stop a life from existing in our universe, but there are things that we can do that will actually prevent us from enjoying it.
Yeah, that's the very powerful piece about the restorationist theology, is the idea that creation itself is restored to its most beautiful actuality. So it's a very lovely thing.
So it could be that Potter had met some of these folks and been influenced by some of the thought, although, again, because this was a kind of secret, you know, the Pietists were worried that if this notion got out into the mainstream, that people would stop acting morally, because of course this is the argument that's always thrown out against universalists and universal salvation, that if we don't have the threat of the afterlife being terrible forever, no one is going to act justly or kindly or compassionately in this life. And so this group came to this realization, but we're like, ugh, we really shouldn't tell anyone about this, because all hell could break loose here on Earth.
Right, so we don't really know if he would have known of the Pietist. It seems most likely to me. There were a lot of the folks that were called German Dunkers in Thomas Potter's neighborhood, and they had some of the Pietistic influence, but they were, of course, as the name tells us, mainly independent Baptists, and it seems most likely to me that we know he had to know those people. They were his neighbors. Which brings us to the other kind of main category of Universalists, which is the huge number of Baptists and Methodists who, not as individuals, but as congregations, come into the idea of universal salvation together. And they were strongest in you know, what we call the Hill Country, and so away from the seaboard, where John Murray was spreading the more official and institutional form of Universalism. But these backcountry Baptists, oh my gosh, they were, you know, very much against any kind of association with state and institution. I think actually they're become a huge part of the American story too, these Baptists and Universalists, because their basic belief was that baptism itself, as well as Christ's power, has unbelievable regenerative strength. And so they have this kernel of belief in regeneration that I think we see again. And this is going to be a kind of scandalous comparison, but I think we see it in Emerson in terms of the divine spark within. And I think we see it in the new thought movements that teach that there is enough divinity within to heal and to change the world with that intention and that power. And I would even go so far to say that we see strains of this in the folks that we now call spiritual but not religious, who seem to, I'm thinking here of Linda Mercadante's work describing what the theology of those folks are, who seem to really believe in all kinds of regenerative notions, that we can regenerate ourselves, and many of them believe in versions of reincarnation that feel more Western than Eastern to me.
And of course, we've left out one ancestor of this kind of Universalist thought that a lot of these Universalists and later Universalists will claim as part of their lineage, which is the Church Father Origen of Alexander. Or is it Alexandria? Origen of Alexandria. He was born, in the year around the year 200, and he was involved in what we would now know as the Catholic Church, the Christian consortium at the time, and he had studied the scriptures and came to the realization in his own way that God wouldn't damn everyone, and came to an early universalism, which was of course refuted by many of those at the time. The interesting thing about Alex's Origen is that he was on, you know, was considered to be on track to be a saint. Where are my words today, Susan? He was on track to be a saint, but Origen had a very almost dualistic understanding of life. He thought that the body was evil, and that the desires of the body were pushing him towards sin, and so he actually castrated himself to stop those desires. And the Catholic Church, you know, say what you will about the Catholic Church, said that this was a fundamental denial of the goodness of creation in the body, and so that he couldn't have been a saint because of that act. And Susan, you were saying that a lot of universalists have created kind of false genealogies to link themselves to Origen as kind of the originator. Oh, so many good puns today of their kind of universalist thought.
Yeah, you know, of course, remember that the Universalists, for most of the years of their existence, were fairly well despised by their neighbors and by officialdom, and so they were constantly trying to demonstrate that they were a legitimate religious tradition. And of course, one way to do that for yourself is to invent a really long history. And so the first histories of the Universalist Church tend to begin not with John Murray, not with the Pennsylvania Pietists, but with the early church fathers, such as Origen and other early church folks who held ideas about salvation that weren't exactly orthodox by later standards. I mean, of course, remember that the early church had theological diversity that we can't even imagine today. And, you know, there's some truth to it, right? I mean, there are certainly examples of early church fathers who believed in universal salvation. And it's going too far to suggest that it's part of a single strand of development, or that there's a true kind of cause and effect ancestry here. And even the theology is subtly different, right? So Origen was so convinced, like so many of the early church fathers, about the reality of Platonic idealism. The Universalists in North America who believe in the regenerative powers of Christ are not really centering their thought in Greek.
I think the reason why this story is so powerful, though, is because it's a story that we as Unitarian Universalists can claim that's sort of exciting. You know, there isn't a lot of power in a lot of our Universalist and Unitarian theological stories in some ways. I mean, exciting debates at Harvard over a chair of theology isn't the most exciting thing to, you know, rouse someone in a sermon. This John Murray, you know, it's kind of like, whoa, what's that? Wow.
Yeah, no, I wish someone out there can help us figure out how to tell better stories about group evolution. Mm. You know, because my favorite stories from our history are like this one and others, the evolution of Unitarianism in Great Britain, where the story is a bunch of people together made collective changes in how they thought over a long period of time. You know, I find that really, that fits my theology of how we are and what the purpose of church is, but it really isn't, you know, no, I don't know how to make a song out of it.
Right, it's not dramatic. You know, it's don't, you know, that go out into the highways and the byways and give them not hell but hope is not the same as slowly evolve through consensus and general painstaking committee meetings so that you can come together to something new and beautiful, which is actually so much closer to the truth of our faith in its everyday existence.
I mean, exactly.
That's how
And there are even some Christian theologians now who are wondering if the story of Jesus shouldn't have been told that way. I'm thinking of Rita Nagashimi Brock, who says, what if we told the story of Christianity not from the point of view of Jesus the hero, but from the point of view of the people who made the people in his community who made that kind of thinking and way of being possible?
And then the people who change Jesus or challenge Jesus and support it, all of those kind of form a web that you can't really understand Jesus without them.
Right, exactly.
So what do you think we can take away from our understandings of John Murray, but also universalist origins in America? What do you want people to leave with?
Well, I think the piece that's exciting to me is just this reminder that each and every one of us is connected to this amazing stream of living tradition. And it doesn't require special skills or special education or special ancestry to have access to some pretty amazing wisdom just by stepping into that stream.
And you know what I'm kind of taking away from this conversation?
Hmm.
It's not so much always about what happened, but how you tell the story. That kind of self-promotional piece on John Murray's part to tell this story is maybe not something we should like fault him for. That good stories and getting the word out there is as important in some ways of kind of having experienced something.
I would agree with you absolutely, but I can't resist just adding one note of caution to that, which is I think our movement has been rich in ministers and storytellers. I'm not sure we cultivate as many historians.
Yes, that's what we're trying to do here, isn't it?
Absolutely. Grow us some historians.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode of The Pamphlet. We always love hearing you. We're getting more and more emails lately from you all talking about our episodes, and it's just great. So keep that up. We love hearing from you. You can email us at info@pamphletpodcast.org. Our next episode is going to be, our next episode is going to be a special episode. It's going to be an exploration of Unitarian Universalists' ministry during the height of the AIDS crisis in Provincetown, Massachusetts. It's an interview. I sit down with Kim Crawford Harvey, and we learn about what it was like to be in that space at the height of AIDS kind of hitting a community and how Unitarian Universalism responded or didn't respond to support the work they were doing, and what church life looked like in that time. It's a really powerful interview, and I'm looking forward to sharing it with all of you.
Season 1 of The Pamphlet is sponsored by the UU House of Study at the Methodist Theological School in Ohio. The Office of Youth and Young Adult Ministries of the Unitarian Universalist Association, and the individual members of the Order for the Promulgation of the Pamphlet, whose financial contributions brought you this episode. For more information on our sponsors or to become a member of the Order, visit our website at pamphletpodcast.org.